Well, good evening and welcome to the sixth presentation in this, our seventh series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum. My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the purple white hair back there, Peggy Wright, with assistance from our webmaster taking pictures and doing the podcast, Taiwan Wan, and our reference coordinator at the back, Brian Carson. Daniel Peach designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Jason Hatman. Our speaker tonight is a native of Antwerp, Belgium, where his parents, who were Polish citizens, had moved in 1924. He was 3 years old when the Germans invaded Belgium in May of 1940. After the harrowing escape described in his new book, One Step Ahead of Hitler, A Jewish Child's Journey Through France, his family emigrated to New York in 1946. Fred graduated from New York University and since has served as a reporter for the Journal Courier, a daily newspaper in New Haven, Connecticut, and has been a public relations specialist for nearly 30 years. He's been actively involved in the Jewish community in Louisville for many years and has spoken frequently about the Holocaust. And in 1988, he testified in favor of a bill requiring Kentucky public schools to offer a Holocaust curriculum at the hearing of the Senate's Education Committee. And a decade later, in the waning days of 2008, such a bill was finally passed and signed into law by Governor Beshear. In the 1980s, having been a frequent speaker about the Holocaust, Fred came to the realization that he knew very little about his family's own life during those years, and began to seriously research that topic with extended conversations with his mother and two brothers. His book was published in April of 2009 by Mercer University Press. And today, Fred and his wife, Carolyn, live in Louisville. They're the parents of four grown sons and several grandchildren and travel frequently. He's an ardent baseball fan and the last ball got to watch the Tampa Bay Rays from the owner's box in Tampa, Florida. Fred's book has drawn national attention. He's going to be an invited speaker in May 9th and 10th at the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. Please give him a warm welcome to Fred Gross.
Thank you, Brian. And thank you to the University Library staff, Peggy Wright, Brian Kutz, Brian Carson. Thank you for doing such wonderful work, and thank you all for coming out tonight to listen to a few things I have to say about myself. The photograph on the right here, those are my brothers, Sammy in the middle and Leo on the right of Sammy, and me. That was in 1985, taken in Antwerp, Belgium. I was on my honeymoon. My brother Sammy was on business in Antwerp at the time. He's a diamond dealer. And my brother Leo, he lived in Paris with his family. So he took the train in. And we gathered together for the first time in Antwerp since the day we left in May 14, 1940. We had never gotten together in the city that we had to escape. And it was an important event because the person who took the photograph was my new wife, Carolyn Humphrey. And Carolyn was always interested in our story, but we never talked about it. So we went to the restaurant, we sat down, and Carolyn started to ask questions. Not of me, because I don't remember much. Not Leo, because he was the quiet one. So she started asking Sammy because he had the most memories. When I was born, Sammy was preparing for his bar mitzvah. So the span of 13 years is huge. And my brother Leo, he was 8 years older than me. So I was the baby of the family for the rest of my life. So we got to talking in the restaurant and Sammy was really hesitant, didn't want to talk about it. He told Carolyn, you know, there are a million stories out there. And, he said, we're not Holocaust survivors. And Carolyn argued that point with him and had argued with me about it too, because I didn't really consider myself as a Holocaust survivor, because I had always had the notion that you were a Holocaust survivor if you survived the death camps. And you really are a survivor if you did that. I even questioned at the end of my book, am I really a Holocaust survivor? So if you read it and come to the end, I leave that up to you. I don't want to answer that question, because I didn't go through the stuff that 1.5 million children went through and were never heard of again. And I dedicate this book to those children. I remember a friend of mine replying to some of my own thoughts not too long ago. I kind of felt guilty, having written the book, of enjoying the moment, getting attention. And he said to me, to feel guilty, in a sense, is, and he used the word, an insult to those children. The children are in a safe place now, and they're looking down at you to keep their memories alive. They can't speak for themselves anymore, but you can. And you can tell people, not about them, but about them through you. This is the way it was before the war. 1939, this picture was taken on the coast of Belgium, the English Channel, in a resort called Knokke, K-N-O-K-K-E. And the family spent its summer vacations there. Sammy, the tall one, he was almost 16 years old. My mother, she was in her 30s. My brother Leo, 11 years old. And here I am, barely 4 years old, 3.5. This is my dad. I don't think I ever saw him in a bathing suit in all the beach pictures that we took. And the reason is because not too far away there was a casino. And my dad loved to go to the casino. And this is a photograph that was taken earlier, around 1938. My dad was always spiffy, always wore a Hamburg. And this is my mother. We all dressed well. My mother made sure of that. She dressed her children well. And she was proud of that. This picture, I'm not too sure, but it looks like it was taken either probably in the fall of 1938, maybe around Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur. It could be. Everybody seems to be quite well-dressed and seem to either going to a synagogue or coming from the synagogue. And this is another photograph taken in probably early 38. We used to walk almost every morning. My mom would take me out for a walk. And on Friday mornings, we would go to the bakery and we would buy the challah for the Friday night Shabbos. And this is my journey. It began here in Antwerp, May 10, 1940. The Germans invade Belgium and the troops aren't there yet. It was mainly bombardments. And we heard the bombardments in early morning of May 10, 1940. We all woke up and really didn't know what was going on until we turned the radio on. And my dad and my mom were listening to it, but we couldn't do anything. We were trapped in our own apartment. My dad didn't have a car. The trains were transporting French and British troops to the front line, and the buses weren't rolling. So we had to stay in our home for 4 days as the German troops kept advancing to Antwerp and to Brussels. And finally we were able to get a taxi, and we left everything in our apartment, the furniture. We just took a few suitcases with us. We even left the photographs behind that you just saw. The photographs were kept by a lady who lived in the apartment, and it was returned to us when we came back in 1946. Isn't that amazing? And there are more photographs in the book. So we went to the coastal area, and this is where the troubles really started. There were hundreds of thousands of refugees who were fleeing from Belgium. And not all of them were Jewish, they were just refugees fleeing from the attacks. And there were times when my mother would throw me into a ditch, and the planes would come swooping down and machine gunning the refugees. Didn't know anything about that until I spoke with my two brothers. And this is the heart of the story of the interviews with my mother and my two brothers. I didn't really begin to get interested in my story until 1988. And that's when I started talking to my mother. I was a newspaper reporter in New Haven, and I did what I knew best, and that was to interview people. So I interviewed my mom in 1988. And then a year later, I interviewed my two older brothers. I wove the interviews within the narrative of the book because I wanted to give them voice. They are responsible for this memoir. I'm not. They are. As well as my dad, with whom I never spoke about. He passed away in 1973, but he hovers over the book because sometimes I get angry thinking, why did you die? I didn't have a chance to talk to you. Because I'm sure that he would have disclosed much more information than my two brothers did and my mother. And I'll read to you some passages where you'll find how difficult it was for me to pull things out of my brothers. They gave mostly one-line answers to some very, very troubling questions. And let me read to you just a few of them. One particular passage. We were being bombarded. We had crossed into France, which was only about 4 miles from the Belgian border. And we were going through Dunkirk. And I asked Leo, well, what was going on? And Leo replied, one night when we were bombed, we had to jump in the ditches because they started to machine gun the people on the road, the Germans. They shot from the planes. This was in France along the French border. Did we go to Dunkirk? Leo, oh yes. And Sam, arguing with Leo, we passed Dunkirk, we just passed it. Leo, no, we heard bombardments there. Sam, we heard bombardments. So, you know, memories can play tricks on you. You remember who's right or who's wrong? Did you see soldiers retreat? Leo, yes. And those were the British soldiers who were retreating to Dunkirk. As early as May 18 of 1940, they were already beginning to retreat there. And then what happened when the soldiers retreated? Leo, sneak attacks by the Nazi fighter planes. Sam, no, we continued. Leo, we passed Dunkirk where the British retreated and we saw thousands of soldiers heading to the beaches. Describe the scene to me. What was it like? Leo, it was, what should I say? It was apocalyptic because you had the bombs falling further up and the planes over you and the people didn't know where to go. Was there a lot of panic? Leo, sure people panicked. They didn't know where to hide. What did we do at night? Leo, this is exactly 50 years ago. This I don't remember. We slept in small hotels. Some slept in cars. Some in wagons. Some of them had horse buggies. If I knew you wanted to write a book, I would have taken notes. That was Leo. And after that, he really didn't say much anymore. Then it was really my mom and my two brothers. And then my mother added a few things too. We were driving through Calais, and the planes were flying over us. When the bombs were being dropped, we lay down on the ground. I threw you into a ditch and covered you with my body. So here I am listening to all of this, and all I could do was to imagine what was going on. Imagining huge plumes of black smoke staining the blue sky. I heard what sounded like a long series of thunderclaps as the bombs exploded upon impact, the ground trembling. I tried to imagine the Nazi planes with a machine gun sticking out from their wings, diving down on us. But all I really heard were the sounds of my family's voices, retelling their alarming adventures. Adventures that often were only shadow memories to the small boy I had been at the time. I was envious of Sam and Leo and Mama because I didn't remember. So did it have an effect on me then if I didn't remember? Let me jump ahead a little bit to 1943, and then I'll come back because this is, I want you to know who I am. I was living with a foster family in 1943. My parents were still in a displaced persons camp in Switzerland. And I went to a Catholic school, and on the first day, you always remember the first day of school. On the first day, the teacher, a sister, she was asking me to draw a picture. And I drew a picture of black sky. Sky was almost all black, and there were flames coming out of the chimney of small houses, and there were birds flying. I guess I expressed myself what I saw. Mm-hmm. The teacher, however, pushed me and said, well, tell me in your words what you saw. And I couldn't. I was even then a reporter. You know, I said, here's the black sky, there are birds flying and flames coming out of chimneys. So many years later on, when I wrote this book and when it was edited, I got back the galleys, and the editor wrote on the galley at this point of my writing, we need to know how formative those experiences were. And it took me a few days to really get into it. I didn't know what to write. I started writing and a couple of sentences, and it just didn't sound right to me. This is what I wrote. Even after my family's long flight to safety, after all I had seen, I didn't yet grasp that planes couldn't fly and shoot by themselves. There were pilots and bombardiers in them, human beings choosing to terrorize and kill other human beings. And as my journey continued, those men inside the planes morphed into the guards and police and jubilating citizens who also wanted to harm me. I was formed by that experience fleeing Belgium, as much as I was formed as a baby growing inside my mother. I had grown in those years we ran, in that world that wanted me dead. And I became possessed by the fear of harm for many, many years. And I feared it most during my teenage years. And I built an imaginary shield around me to keep others at a distance. I still see her, the one with the lovely face, resembling a teenage Elizabeth Taylor, her jet black hair resting on her shoulders, following me in high school, in the hallway, behind me in the cafeteria line, even meeting me by chance on the subway one afternoon, and she telling me so gently that she wanted to go out with me. And that was when I was in high school in Queens. But it came over me, my heart pumping with fear, dismissing her rudely, my shield firmly in place. And so I turned into a lonely, silent youth and shunned many opportunities to have a social life with friends, to have a normal life. Saturday nights, I would tell my mother that I was going out on a date, but instead would go out alone, sometimes riding the subway all night until it was time to go home. Other times, I went out drinking. I loved going to Birdland in Manhattan, listening to the giants of jazz, Dizzy Gillespie, Count Basie, Joe Williams, moving cautiously inside myself to the rhythm of the beat. And then I write about the nightmares that I had, about planes crashing down on me. Even as late as April of 2008, my wife and I were dining in a restaurant at a patio, and suddenly I heard a tremendous roar, and I said to Carolyn, "God, I think there's a plane crashing down." And I dove under the table, and it was a freight train passing by. I'm trying as best as I could let go of some of these things and to look more to the future than the past. But it's difficult because since this book came out, all that people want of me is to talk about my past. And I'm getting a little bit better. And I acknowledge that by saying, I know I cheated myself by imagining harm coming to me. The confidant keeps reminding me, the Nazis are gone. You don't have to be afraid anymore. There are no Nazis in your life. So let's continue with the journey.
Did you speak Flemish or French?
At home, yeah. We spoke German. Because my father came originally from Frankfurt. He was born in Frankfurt, although he never became a citizen of Germany. He was a citizen of Poland because his parents were Polish. And my mother, she was born in Poland, and she met my father in Germany. And I'll tell you about that later on. Here we are being strafed, and then all that we could do was to continue down. At one point, we were picked up by a pickup truck right in this area in Abbeville, and we driver, and not only us, but others who were on the truck, took us to Dieppe. And at that point, when we were driving down, when that story was told to me by Leo, I asked him, well, what about the other refugees who were walking, and did they get any rides? And he said something really interesting to me. He said, that I don't know, you know. We were only interested in ourselves. So you get into a situation like that where one's survival is at stake, you think about yourself. And that happened to my father a few years later when we were down in France. So we took a train then from Dieppe to Paris. My father was a diamond dealer. He had money. Hours after the bombing stopped in Antwerp, he ran to the bank to get his diamonds out and to get all the money out. So he was resourceful. And whatever happened, you had to have money. You couldn't get on a train without money. You know, we stayed in a little bed and breakfast for a day. You had to pay. But many couldn't. Many slept at night, you know, on the ground outside. There was one time where in a little village right around here, we stopped at night and we were sleeping in a movie house. There was no movie going on at that time. So we ended up in Paris for a few days. And when we heard that the Germans were coming down to France, having defeated the Belgians and the Dutch, we then took a train from Paris and we went all the way down to Bordeaux. And in Bordeaux, we stayed for about 3 weeks with thousands of other refugees. We were all going the same way, especially the Jews. Most of them who were going down that way were Jewish, because they knew that Hitler was coming after us. And so we stayed in Bordeaux for about 3 weeks. We did get a visa, identification cards signed by a Portuguese consul, Mendes, who helped save tens of thousands of Jews cross into Spain in that period, and who died a pauper because he was ostracized by his own government. And so we went from Bordeaux, we took a taxi down to Hendaye, and the taxi driver had told us, you're never going to get into Spain. This was what we wanted to do, is to cross into Spain. and with thousands of other people, you know, hurrying through that area. And we could have gone through Spain, but there were reports going around that the French, the Spanish were guarding the border, and that also the Gestapo was already down there in advance of the German troops, because they wanted to make sure the coastal area would be secured by the Nazis. And then we heard the reports were that the French were stopping young men, like my brother, 16, 17 years old, to draft them in the army. I mean, it was a crazy period. And so my mom became scared and said, uh-oh, we're not going close to the border. And so we went then from Hyundai to Dux. We were hidden by a farmer in a barn for a few days. And here I have to say that all along the way here and all the way up here, we were helped by people who were not Jewish. They were Christians, they were Catholics, and then of course there were also people who just didn't believe in God but had a moral obligation to save people. And there was the farmer and the Catholic nuns and the Catholic family and the mayor of a small village. All along the way, we were helped. Now, it took me a long time to understand that notion that they were good people. Despite all the horror that was happening, there were good people. And I began to understand that with the help of my wife. She's not Jewish, she's Baptist. And she kind of guided me through and made me aware that all those people, you know, who rescued you did it because they love you. They wanted to save you. They wanted to, and even risk their own lives to save us. And then that was backed up by a book that I read called The Righteous Gentiles of the Holocaust, where this writer, professor of Christian ethics, researched and wrote about normal people defying their own government to save Jews. And this professor happened to have written the foreword to my book from Mercer University, and is responsible for having this book published by Mercer University Press. And I spent a few days with him earlier this week. So here we are in Dux. Suddenly, after a few days, the farmer comes into the barn and said, we have to go. And so from there, we walked through some woods, and there were some international Red Cross buses that were transporting refugees all across this area and dropping them off in numerous villages for safety. So we were dropped off in Po, and we slept in a school gym in Po for a few days. That was about near the end of June of 1940. Now, I know all of these dates because when my mom died in 1989, I discovered in her hatbox documents, identification documents, because all along the way, these documents had to be stamped by the police. Not only that, when my parents went to the bank to exchange Belgian francs for French francs, and they were signed by officials of the bank, and it gave the amount that they took out. And those documents served really as my roadmap to my journey. And so we went from Po, we slept in the school gym for a few days, and then suddenly the police came storming in one morning, the French police, and told us that we had to vacate the premises, to board some buses, and they would drop us off at the other villages along the way. They dropped us off in internment camp, Gurs. My mom, my brother Leo and I, my mom and me, were just in one part of the camp, the women's, and in the other, my two brothers and my dad. I don't know which was which, but we were separated. and the conditions were horrible. It was a rainy season, muddy. The barracks were made out of thin wood. We slept on straw beds, and there were people dying of disease, especially, you know, many elderly people were dying, and the conditions were horrible. Eventually, when more and more Jews were transported into this camp, it turned into a concentration camp, not a killing camp. There were no executions or anything like that, but we couldn't get out. In 1942, there were 4,000 Jews in this camp, and they were all transported to Auschwitz by the French. By the French. Now, why am I here to tell you this story? About 2 weeks after we were in the camp, Sammy escaped from the camp and, with the help of a village mayor, got some documents to take back to the camp, ordering the commander to release the family. This was a period in June and July when the French government hadn't yet been firmly formed, and so there were opportunities to escape and to hide out. And that all closed down in October of 1940, when the Vichy government then began to execute its anti-Semitic laws against the foreign Jews and also against the French Jews. And they were similar to the Nuremberg laws. And they did that without any prodding from the Nazis. This was a French government that was dominated by officials who were anti-Semitic. And this is about the age that Sammy was when he escaped from camp. We continued on in our journey after we were released, and we took a train from Oloron-Sainte-Marie. The mayor transported us to the train station, or one of his people. And then we took the train from Oloron to Toulouse, from Toulouse to Marseille. And in Marseille, we stayed there until October of 1940. And that's when we had to leave, because that's when the anti-Semitic laws were implemented in 1940. And we escaped into the French Riviera. And we escaped into the French Riviera. Quite an interesting place to escape to. When France surrendered to Germany in June of 1940, almost on that day, or maybe a day later, or even maybe a day before, Mussolini decided to invade the French Riviera. And Mussolini, of course, was an ally of Hitler. But we had heard, my family had heard, that the French Riviera was a safe place to be. The Italian diplomats in the French Riviera, they helped us. They helped save Jews. And they protected us from the French police and from the Gestapo and the SS that would come in there. Because the SS, they knew that there were tens of thousands of Jews who were living on the French Riviera. From about end of October to 1940 to August of 42, we stayed in Nice. My brother Sammy, he escaped to Portugal in April of 42 because we had heard that the French police were rounding up young men for slave labor camps. So it was now my parents, me, and Leo. There were a number of people living in the hotel who were also Jewish. And it was around June or July, they began to hear what was going on throughout Europe and what was happening in Eastern Europe. And so one of my dad's relatives who lived in the hotel implored on my dad, "You have to leave now." That was around June or July, because that family was leaving. Apparently they were originally from Italy, and so they were able to escape into Italy, and then from there to America. My dad decided to stay. Apparently he said, "I'm not ready." And I remember that conversation. I was there when that conversation occurred, and when this man, my dad's a distant relative, you know, pleaded with him to come. August 25, we still didn't know what was going on. somebody comes running into the hotel, again another distant cousin, and told us, "You need to leave now, Max. The hotel is going to be raided the next morning, 4 or 5 o'clock. How did this person know? A policeman told him, a French policeman, because that French policeman knew exactly when these raids were going to occur. The Ministry of Interior ordered the French police to begin the roundups, and that would begin in Nice August 26th. So that same day, the day before, we left. Now again, in Nice, there was a beautiful casino on the Mediterranean Sea. And my dad called up this Italian Catholic man, whom he really got to know well at the casino, and called him and asked him whether he would hide us out. He came to pick us up. "This is Leo and me. He's teaching me how to ride a bike at the hotel. You can see the palm trees and a bed of flowers, all in the grass, neatly trimmed. And this is, again, Leo and me. We were walking on the promenade on the Mediterranean Sea. And here are my parents." These pictures were taken in 1941. We were all skinny because there was rationing of food. And I remember I kept myself well-fed by just eating tangerines, maybe 2 dozen tangerines a day. And I still love them. And here is Sammy in 1941. What a difference a year or so makes from the earlier picture to this picture. He told me that his teeth were falling out. He was all emaciated. But he was a cool guy. Look at it, look at the way he dressed. It was his sort of authoritarian look, his conceit, that helped him escape into Portugal, because he had to take a train from Nice all the way back to Po. And then he also, prior to that, he had to get an exit visa to leave France, a transit visa to go through Spain, and a entrance visa to get into Portugal. And these visas were only good for 30 days. So by the time he got all the visas, the Portuguese visa had expired. My dad said, because he had to go to various other cities to get those visas, the French visa, he had to go all the way up to Vichy to get. And he got it from a French government official whom my dad's relatives knew, and he bribed him to get the French visa. And then he went all the way back. By the time he came back, the Portuguese visa had expired, but my dad said, "Go ahead, take the train. Go." And so he took the train to Po. And when he walked into the Portuguese consulate in Po, they told him, "You know, there are people who are looking for you." To this day, he doesn't know who. But the Portuguese consul gave him, extended the visa, and he left for Spain and then for Portugal. So here are good people. Again, good people helping out. The Portuguese consul could have easily arrested Sammy. The Portuguese dictator, he was sympathetic to the Nazis. So we hid out in that family's, Catholic family's home for about 3 or 4 weeks. And then we had to leave. My father said it's too dangerous to stay in Nice. The roundups were continuing into September. People were being picked up on the street. And so we then took a train from Nice to Grenoble. And then in Grenoble, that was around middle of September of 1940. In Grenoble, we were helped out by Catholic nuns. They hid us for a few days in a convent and made arrangements for us to escape to Switzerland with the help of a smuggler. So in early October, we then left Grenoble. They said it was safe for us to leave Grenoble. And we took a train near the Swiss border, and not too far away from Geneva. And we stopped at an Alpine village, met the smuggler. He guided us to a little hotel where we had dinner, and then took us to the back of the hotel and told us to go into a little barn to stay there until he would wake us up about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. And he did. And so we advanced towards Switzerland, middle of the night. We could hear the trucks, and one of my cousins told me that those trucks were manned by the French police, looking for Jews who were trying to cross into Switzerland. Now, the Swiss did not let Jewish people in. They barked at it. Thank God that the humanitarian organizations in Switzerland protested so hard that the Swiss government relaxed its policy of not allowing Jews to cross into their country. But again, when you went to these borders, it was really up to the border guards to decide. So when we got to the border, the Swiss border guard told us, you know, we're only allowing people in who have relatives living in Switzerland. And those who don't have any relatives living in Switzerland, they were sent back and walked right into the hands of the French police. This is my mother when she was a teenager, and my grandmother, a widow. It was in Leipzig, Germany, that they lived. Around the time of World War I, I'm not sure whether it was before or after or during. Anyway, she was a widow. And in Leipzig, she met a traveling salesman from Switzerland. And she was pretty. I mean, she's a striking woman. And he fell in love with her, wanted to marry her and take her to Switzerland. But he didn't want to take my mother. And so my grandmother had to make a decision. My future grandmother had to make a decision. Stay with her daughter or go with her man. And she decided to go with her man to Switzerland and placed my mother in an orphanage. She never really recovered from that experience. She never mentioned it to me, but she did mention it to a granddaughter. And I didn't find out what really happened until I was about in the middle of this book, and she had already passed away. She had always told me that she couldn't get a visa to go with them to Switzerland. But the truth is that her mother placed her in an orphanage and abandoned her.
How old was she?
She was here about 15 years old. Uh-huh.
And that's when she abandoned her?
Yeah.
Wow.
14, 15, a time when a young girl like that needs a mother.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was around 1915, 1916, I think, around that time. The war was still going on. In 1918, well, maybe even after the war, because she was born in 1903, so by 1918 she was only 15 years old.
Was her father killed in World War I?
No, her father died when she was 9 years old, yeah, in Poland. And so we were allowed into Switzerland, but we weren't free yet.
Were you allowed in Switzerland because of her?
Because of her, yes. She told the guard that her mother lived in Switzerland, and the guards did call the police in the town that my grandmother lived in, Zurich, to confirm that this is true. And it was. So we were allowed into Switzerland. Now, but we weren't free yet, because they transported us to Swiss to displaced persons camps. My mother and Leo and I were in one displaced persons camp in Switzerland, and my father was transported to another displaced persons camp that was, Leo told me, more like a slave labor camp. During that period that my dad and my mom were in there, not soon after we were placed in the displaced persons camp, Leo and I were given the opportunity to be adopted by foster parents. Jewish agencies came in and ask the parents whether they would like to have their children placed. They can go to school, live a normal life, etc. And that's what happened. About February of 1943, I was placed with a family that lived in St. Gallen, Switzerland, near the German border. And my brother was placed with a family that lived in Zurich, the town where my grandmother lived. So we were separated. So here, the whole family was separated. My mom was in a displaced persons camp by herself. My dad was in a displaced persons camp by himself. Sammy was in Portugal. Leo was in Zurich. I was in St. Gallen. Yes.
Did your parents have to pay to get you placed?
No. No. It was families, I think, probably did it out of the goodness of their heart. Yes. Now, I don't know. Maybe the Jewish agencies paid the families. That I don't know. So these are my classmates in St. Gallen. And I had a good time there for less than a year, except for one thing. They had a son who abused me, the family. And that was the tough part. Physically, sexually, and then one day this son just vanished. Somebody had warned me, a little child whom I was introduced to when I first got to the foster home, warned me of this boy, that he was hot-tempered, he was violent, and of course, and the thing is, I slept in the same bedroom that he slept in. And so that put a lot of stress on me. But yet, you know, I did have a good time, because especially when I went to school and when I was with my friends. I had a good
time. The German part of Switzerland, they talk German?
In St. Gallen they talked French.
Oh.
Yes. Uh-huh. Zurich they talked German. Yes. Because I remember talking to this little child in French, and with her mother. So I lived in, I was reunited with my parents in February of 44. I was away from them for a little over a year. In February of 44, they had already been discharged from the displaced persons camp. And we all lived with whom? Whom did we live with?
Grandmother.
My grandmother. And
I wonder how that reunion was.
Oh, my gosh. But you know, my mom was a kind-hearted person. I think she had forgiveness in her heart. My father hated her. Mm-hmm. I didn't know, but I think I would have hated her too. Maybe not, who knows. But my dad didn't like her. And they had arguments together, Rachel and my father. Of course, my father was not, he was not the best of people himself. Gambler, womanizer, all kinds of stuff. Didn't want to pay the rent to her. He was a tough character. But he came through when we needed him. So when I write about him, there is no hatred on my part. In fact, I started to fall in love with the guy.
The character?
Character, yeah. Uh-huh. So we lived in Zurich until early 1946. And here is my best friend, Max Maurer, and me. I look happy in this picture, mm-hmm. but not here.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really is the end of my story. Then in April of 46, we come to America, New York City. We left Antwerp, went back to Antwerp, gathered the photographs. The pictures that were taken in France were intermittently sent to my grandmother. So she had those photographs. And Sammy took some photographs with him too when he escaped to Portugal. I mean, we didn't have anything in our possession. You know, we didn't carry a suitcase to go across the border into Switzerland. Uh-huh. So, and we got a visa to come to America in April of 46. But at that time, it was easy to get a visa. You know, before, especially right after Pearl Harbor, it was almost impossible to get an American visa, especially those who came from Poland and Germany, because the State Department was afraid that they would become German agents in America. Mm-hmm. And there's a story about that too. Right, Carol?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And so we docked at Norfolk, Virginia. I get off with my family. They drive us to the train station. What happens is something really interesting. At Norfolk, Virginia, I had no idea when we arrived later in the city of Norfolk that Virginia practiced discrimination against another race, blacks, as did much of the country prior to the civil rights movement. It took some time before I fully understood how my new homeland had its own version of some of what we had experienced in World War II. African Americans attended separate schools from whites, were refused service at hotels and restaurants, and were relegated to the back seats of public buses. We had to wait a while to board the train to New York, where we would be united after a four-year absence with our brother Sam. After about a half-hour wait on a bench outside the station, I went to the restroom, where I saw a little old man, probably more than 70 years old, wearing a crumpled brown hat, brown tweed jacket, and baggy brown pants. And when we made eye contact, his sweet smile creased his weather-beaten face. He had skin darker than I had ever seen. Exiting together, I saw Leo talking with a blonde, crew-cut young man. "What's the matter?" I asked my brother in German. "He told me you shouldn't have gone in there," Leo replied. "Why not?" Leo pointed to the restroom sign. It read, "Colored men only." Mm-hmm. And that is the conclusion of my book. And it had a tremendous amount of influence on me that moment. Because when I became a reporter in New Haven, I was a pretty good reporter. I was the lead reporter for the civil rights riots, for the Vietnam War protests. And that moment at the train station educated me to the fact that, my gosh, I'm not the only one persecuted. There are others persecuted, discriminated against. And that, in effect, became the groundwork for my quest for social justice, even as a reporter. I'm done. Questions?
Questions?
When you were in foster care, were you under the knowledge that you were going to see your family again? Were you assuming that as a young
person? No, I was not under, no. Looking back, I didn't even think about it.
You just went.
Pardon me?
There's probably no time to think about it.
Yeah, I didn't even think about it. I was having a good time. You know. I was a normal kid. In the summertime, I would walk barefoot. In the wintertime, I would ski to school. We lived right across from a farm with cows grazing. I mean, it was a good time, despite the problems that I had with the family. Yes?
Was the reason that you came to America because your brother was here already, or was there another alternative to the United States?
No.
Like Israel, or?
No, I don't think we... Israel didn't come... that didn't come across our mind. We wanted to be free. And my dad was promised a good job and a home from the American relatives. We came here, yeah. Yes?
Because of your religion and culture, being a Jew,
yes.
How did that affect you in the long run? Do you still kind of call yourself a devout Jew? Do you still practice Jewish law?
As I said a few minutes ago, My mission was to work for social justice. So as a Jew, we strongly believe in social justice. I belong to a Reformed temple. And that is, you know, there's a Hebrew word, tikkun olam, which means to repair the world. And this is how I feed my spirituality. I don't go to synagogue much. I go on the high holy days. I don't observe kosher, but I do what I do to help people, whether they're Jewish or not. Doesn't matter to me. Yes? Anybody else?
You mentioned in somewhere in the book you had a...
Let me show you a few more pictures, okay?
Go ahead.
Life goes on. This is me back in Belgium in 1946. This is me on American military freighter coming to America. These are my four sons. And I'm proud of them.
Yeah, Beth, over here.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
You mentioned that it sounds like going back into your history and asking questions of your family was an incredibly meaningful experience for you, and you shared that with us. But that looking back is heavy in a way. And I'm curious what looking forward is for you. Do you have a next project? Are you thinking about another book, about another reporting job or so?
Well, I am thinking about another book. This probably will be fiction, but it'll be a novel about my mother and do some more research work on her. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I do is I paint. I'm learning how to paint. I go to painting class. And I talk to kids a lot. And I talk also to kids who are in detention, because I think they can identify with me. And of course, my family. John and I, they keep me active. John, especially Jonathan, who's 22 years old. Adam, married and has three daughters. Josh is married and father of a new son. And Mark lives in St. Thomas, he's a bartender. Josh is a publicist, and he works for me pro bono. Adam is in private banking at J.P. Morgan Chase. And these three live in New York. Jonathan has been in New York now for a year. He works for a film company as a production assistant. And he is also, I had mentioned that during dinner, a rising star in music, but a particular kind of music, hip-hop. So here we have a rising Jewish hip-hop artist.
And on that note, it's time for our door prize. Everyone in for the door prize?
His name is Johnny Spanish. Okay. Google him, you'll find him.
Who produced his album?
Should be aware of this. Comes from your neighborhood. But he just finished doing a remix with Nappy Roots.
Nappy Roots. Mm-hmm. Oh, Warren Central here involved.
Yeah. Perfect. Right. Well, thank you for coming. I really appreciate it.
WKU Libraries
and
the Kentucky Museum Friends organization who sponsored this. We want to thank them especially. We want to thank you for coming out. Fred will be signing copies of his fascinating book. I read it last night. It kept me up till 2 in the morning. It's one of the most intriguing stories I've read in a very long time at the back. We hope you'll join us again on the 25th of this month back here when we'll be having Professor John Moore from the University of Alabama, Birmingham. We'll be talking about pilgrimage, the great pilgrimage from the Pyrenees to Santiago de Compostela. So again, thanks very much and have a good evening.